Philip Morgan.
Listen.io. Good to see you, my man. Oh, you know who came up in the news the other day? You remember Kim.com?
Yes. What was the name of that website? Mega Upload?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
He came up in the news. He's still like trying to get the country of New Zealand to protect him from extradition. And anyway,
to the U.S. Yeah.
I think he's slowly losing that battle. And I think he's eventually going to get extradited and brought before court for stuff that.
Just think about how many new Bitcoin cryptocurrency founders will be in his exact position within 10 years. Just think about that for a second.
It's going to be quite a ride, I imagine, for them.
Yeah. It was so interesting. His defense was, so Mega Upload, if you don't know, was a site where people could basically post torrent files, I believe, and then you could, what's that?
Sorry to interrupt, dude. It wasn't torrent. It was just you post whatever stuff you wanted, like kind of in the clear, and it was
right.
Used quite, I guess, widely and effectively for piracy and copyright violation stuff.
Well, so it was essentially a place where he would host your file and then other people could come download it. And so his defense was, well, I didn't post any of these files. There's no copyright violation, which is absurd.
Which is interesting because the EU recently just narrowly avoided advancing a potential piece of legislation that would raise that same question for anybody who has a hosting platform of any kind, where anything that was a copyright violation, now the hosting platform provider would be liable. And it does raise some tricky, sticky questions about how the internet works. So, I mean, that guy's kind of a joke, and he's like very, I don't think he thinks he's a joke, but he's kind of a joke in that he's just so outrageous in who he is, but it touches on some actually, I guess, bigger, more interesting questions.
Well, I mean, should you be able to rent a movie on demand, record it, and then post it to YouTube? Like, they've already stopped that for years.
Right. And that's the concern, is that every, even little hosting companies now need to have the sophistication that a big giant like YouTube or Google has to be able to respond to DCMA takedown notices and stuff like that. I know this is super fascinating information that we're sharing here.
I know. It would be amazing if anyone's still with us, but I will continue down this road. I felt that exact same way about GDPR,
yeah,
which is the new, what is it? General Data Protection Regulation, GDPR.
Okay. You passed that part of the test. It does stand for that. Did you do anything in response to that coming into effect a month or so ago?
No, I didn't. And I really do think it's one of these things where it's a piece of legislation written for large companies, and it's just like not really practical or likely or even possible for companies our size to really do a lot about that. But I do believe what's going to happen is like my email software will have tools built in eventually that just addresses it, and I won't have a choice.
Yeah, which I think is fine. I did a sort of best effort attempt at compliance with GDPR, and I'm nowhere near quote-unquote compliant. But also, I think about the things GDPR stipulates, and I'm like, gosh, I've never had anybody request that I delete the data that I have on their on file on them, which is
right
at most a name and a like a mailing address and an email address. That's about the most, and a history of some kind of interaction.
Yeah, I was going to say some tags about their behavior.
Yeah, but never has anybody said, would you please delete that? If they had, I would have been like, huh, I'd be happy to. Let me figure out how to do that.
Sure, right. That's what I would have said too.
Yeah.
I would have said, that's not a problem, and you're the first person to ever ask me that.
Yeah. So I just added a sort of additional layer of informed consent, I suppose. And I said, yeah, I just basically added double opt-in everywhere where I had been single opt-in, which I was craving to do that anyway, because it contributes to a higher quality list.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you find that you get fewer opt-ins now?
My list net size has been like flat, zero net growth for.
Okay.
I talked about this elsewhere. I think I may have talked about it here a little bit. I implemented a basket of changes. I had put up a single opt-in form on a friend's website.
Yes.
And that website apparently gets a lot of low traffic or low quality traffic. So I was getting a ton of opt-ins that were just garbage. And I started getting frustrated with that. And so for about a month, I segmented my list, and anyone who appeared to not be engaging with the emails, I don't love that word, but whatever, drip didn't, said they hadn't opened X number of emails, hadn't clicked anything in X number of emails. For them, I said, I'm about to delete you from my list, but if you click here, I'll keep you on my list. Ran that as a sort of banner at the top of emails for, I don't know, 3 weeks. And then I was going to do it for a month, got impatient and said, screw it. So I deleted all those people and it cut my list in half. It went from close to, I think it was about a little over 4,000, went to a little over 2,000. Then I also implemented all this extra opt-in stuff. One of which is after a 2-week trial period, if you don't want to stay on my list, I just delete you automatically and you have to click a link to stay subscribed. So in some cases, it's a triple opt-in.
Oh, interesting.
And I'm not doing, I kind of took my foot off the pedal with podcast guesting. That was the main thing I was doing to grow my list. So that resulted in probably a 6-month period of like flat stagnation in terms of list growth. And I'm not unhappy with that. I feel like I'm kind of simmering my list and it's becoming higher and higher quality. Like more and more of the people that are there, I think really want to be there, really are interested in what I'm saying. And so that feels okay to me. And stuff that I sell, like this workshop I'm doing this month, sells really well. So I don't feel like I have a problem I need to fix in the short term.
Okay.
But maybe in the medium long term, I do have a problem I need to fix. So anyway, just to answer your question, that's where I'm at with GDPR, not our topic for this week.
Not our topic. And one thing that I realized, Philip, is we do no branding on this show.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, I realized that if someone were to tune in to, say, this episode right now, we've spent 5 or more minutes already talking about a bunch of stuff that's not related to the show, and we don't even say what the show is or why people should listen.
What's the show called?
The show is called Offline.
Okay.
Featuring Philip Morgan and Liston Witherell.
Yeah.
We don't even have a tagline, do we?
No. Do we need one of those?
I thought it was something like, yeah, do we need one? Maybe not. But it wasn't it like what online consultants talk about when they're offline? Something like that.
That was in the mix somewhere along the way. You're right. Yeah, we don't. I just assume people know from our larger reputation. But you're right. We don't really do much to help out the neophytes or the people who dive in 11 minutes into an episode.
Yeah, I'm just writing your coattails. It's not my reputation that matters here.
We'll get you there, buddy. We'll get you there.
Well, thank you. Thank you. So is there anything you want to promote today, Philip?
Well, I want folks to know that this second workshop I'm doing in specialization school is called Deepening Market Insight. It's getting close to having the first cohort of people done with it, and it's going very well. I have so many good things to relate about the fact that we're doing something that's hard, which is market research, where you reach out to strangers and ask them to talk to you. And it's going well, and people are succeeding because I feel like the structure is enough and the pacing is not too fast. And I don't know, maybe I sound like a jerk bragging about this thing, but I put a lot of work into it, and it's the result of multiple years of me doing things kind of the wrong way or seeing where things don't work in the real world. So it's really gratifying to see this actually work and people having really productive conversations to learn more about a market they don't understand well enough. So that's specialization school, and that's me celebrating the fact that it's the structure is really helpful to help people achieve their goals. How about you? Anything you want to promote today?
Yeah, the thing I'd like to promote is my new podcast, the Liston.io show. So the big difference between Offline featuring Philip Morgan and Liston Witherell and the Liston.io show. Sorry, Philip is about to spit out his drink as I said that. The big difference between this podcast and that podcast is, I'd say, formality. And also I have different guests.
You say sir and ma'am a lot more, right?
I do, and I would never say fuck on that podcast, which I'm fine saying it here.
Yeah.
But I do solo episodes that are very focused on a topic and research and a little bit more in depth. And I also do interviews with people that you would like to hear from, including other consultants. I'm going to do a series called Coffee with Consultants, which has a nice alliteration,
hmm.
where I'll be asking people about their own businesses and kind of what's going right, what's going wrong, what lessons they've learned along the way. So liston.io show, you can pick it up wherever you're listening to this podcast. It's there too.
I think you're going to have to pay Jerry Seinfeld some royalties on that name. I love that though, Coffee with Consultants.
That's not bad, right?
That's good. This is the first time I'm hearing it, so this is my hot take, and my hot take is hot damn, I like it.
All right, sweet. So let's have coffee with each other right now, Philip. You posed this interesting topic, and it has to do with embarrassment. Can you say a little bit about that?
Here's what I wrote in our board on Asana. Trust yourself. How do you take on stretch goals in a way that leads to growth in your business rather than embarrassing failures? And I did my usual pretty half-assed job of setting this topic up. And this is kind of something I want to talk through with you. I don't have a bunch of talking points here that I'm going to click through, or, you know, I don't have much of a plan other than this idea. And to me, the idea is super compelling. It keeps coming up over and over again. The idea is nobody gives you the business you want to have 5, 10, 20 years from now. Nobody just hands that to you on a silver platter. I think maybe in some situations, particularly with the licensed professions like being a CPA or an attorney, you get a little more help from a system that's set up to help you build a good business.
Mm-hmm.
But with us, there's no licensing for what we do, which I think is wonderful. But that also means that, like, how do you build a really fucking great business? Nobody just says, well, here's the recipe, do it. Like, if that's what you want, I think you open a dry cleaning business or something like that, where it's just like not everybody knows how to run a dry cleaning business, but there's a plan out there for you. If you want to run a dry cleaning business, there's a script you can follow, essentially.
Yeah, there's definitely people you can call and figure out how they're running their businesses and why.
Yeah, I'm sure there's consultants that'll help you set up a dry cleaning business and tell you what to do. And chances are you'll do okay if you do what they say.
Right.
And I feel like there's fewer sort of best practices or templates to follow in the world of what we're doing and what I suppose many of our listeners are doing. And so I'm kind of compelled by this idea that to get a really great business or to build a really great business, you got to take some risks and you have to try some things that might be uncomfortable.
Right.
I've called this like leaning out ahead of your skis or leaning out on your skis in the past. This idea that you do things that are a little bit beyond what you're comfortable doing now. And I'm not talking about, oh, make 10 cold calls a day or whatever. I'm talking about from the perspective of your expertise. I mean, you're a great example, Liston. Nobody anointed you sales trainer. Nobody said, you know, Liston, here's a business you can buy. There's no like franchise for what you do that you can just buy into.
Right.
You have to figure this stuff out for yourself through experience. And that means making decisions about how far you're going to go beyond your current level of comfort and expertise. So that's what I wanted to talk through with you is, and I don't think we're going to end up with like three simple best practices that you can use to figure out how to do this. I think it's a kind of a feel thing, like you kind of feel your way through it, or it is for me. But also, I don't think your business gets a lot better if you don't take some of these risks of like, let me take on this client who wants me to do this thing. I've never quite done it before. It's a little bit of a stretch goal, maybe, but I'm going to take it on. I'm going to trust myself to be able to do it. I'm going to trust myself to communicate with them, to let them know that there's some risk here because of whatever. Anyway, I think I've said enough. That's what I had in mind when I threw this topic out.
So when you say stretch goal, do you mean take on a new service or a new type of client? Or do you mean, I think when I hear people say stretch goal in the context of growing a business, they often mean a revenue goal or a sales goal. Is that what you mean? Or do you just mean it more generally? Just sort of like living outside of your comfort zone?
I mean it more generally. So I'll give an example. I think somewhere in the year 2017, I said to myself, I would like to just run a business that sells advisory services.
I see.
You know, I don't build things for people. I help them, but I don't write copy for people. I write a template that they can customize themselves, but I don't write copy that goes on their website, which is something I used to do a fair bit of. I don't write an email sequence for somebody. I give them guidance on how to do that. And I think within a year, that was true for me. That was the business I had. Now, I was partially all part of the way there at the time that I'm talking about. So I had a head start. It didn't take just a year, because that makes me look way smarter than I am or way more effective at doing this stuff than I really was.
Sure.
But still, I think even if in 2 or 3 years somebody could execute that kind of change in their business, it's a reinvention of the business as it's going. And for some people, that might be like a lifelong accomplishment. That might be huge. It has been huge for me. I'm not dismissing it. I'm just saying it's a big deal. Mm-hmm. So that's more the thing I'm talking about, where you say, you know what, I want something better for myself. And so when I say a stretch goal, I don't mean, well, I'd like to make 200,000 this year. And if I make 250, I'll be over the moon. And 250 is a stretch goal and 200 is the minimum goal. I'm saying I would like to gain some capabilities in myself that I don't have as of now. And to do that, no one's going to hand me that opportunity. I have to go after it. And to do that, I have to take some risks. That's more what I'm talking about.
Okay. First of all, let me tell you a story about an embarrassing failure in my life.
Sweet. Yes, this is why I'm doing this episode.
This is not business related. I can tell one that's business related that happened about 2 years ago now. But the first moment in my life, maybe not the first. I think this is the second, like, gigantic embarrassment, public embarrassment.
Okay, okay.
I was in fifth grade, Philip, and I sat next to my fifth grade crush.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, high pressure situation all the time.
High stakes, baby. Yeah.
High stakes. Like, what if you do or say the wrong thing?
Yeah.
And I was chewing on a pen, you know, fifth grade, about the time you start to use a pen instead of a pencil to write.
Okay.
So pens were fairly new to me. And I was chewing on the back of the pen. And somehow it like came apart. And unbeknownst to me, as I sit there chewing on this pen, there's black ink splattered all over my face.
Love it.
And my crush, of course, turns to me and starts laughing uncontrollably because I have black ink all over my face and I have no idea. And I'm sort of like, what's going on? And I start to turn bright red. And the teacher looks at me and goes, what happened? I still have no idea what's going on.
Okay.
And the whole class looks at me and erupts in laughter. So the teacher goes, oh, you have pen on your face. Go wash it off.
Uh-huh.
And so I sheepishly, like, by myself, go out of the room and go into the bathroom and wash it off. So that was a very impactful moment in my life. I probably actually was much shyer after that for many years as a result of that experience.
When I think about that, I think the real moment in that story is you're walking back in the classroom, right? You don't just run out and, like, go home or hide out for the rest of the day, right?
Right. I have to face the aftermath of the embarrassment.
Right. But that's the moment of truth of, like, how are you going to handle that?
Uh-huh.
What happened?
My guess is I just pretended it never happened. I just go to recess and say, let's play kickball and try not to talk about it.
I mean, were there consequences? Did you get a mean nickname? Did you get made fun of afterwards? No.
Not that I recall. No, No. I'm sure it was a much bigger deal to me than to anyone else.
So that's really the close to the most embarrassed you've been your whole life, or is that just an early experience of embarrassment?
There were college moments of embarrassment, which I shouldn't talk about.
Okay. That's for our other X-rated podcast.
Yeah. If it were like whiskey with Liston and Philip, then maybe I would say it, but...
Underground. That's what that one's called. This one's offline.
Yeah.
That one's underground.
Underground. Yeah. Subterranean with Philip and Liston. There were some other embarrassing moments, but that was probably one of the worst.
Okay.
Now, I will share a business story, and it has to do exactly with what you're saying about stretch goals. So when I was running my agency, at some point I'd become convinced that, well, I knew that a major weakness for us was getting traffic. So we were doing conversion rate optimization and doing customer insights and helping people improve their messaging and doing some content, but we weren't able to drive traffic very well. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, we should really learn some sort of paid acquisition channel so we can kind of turn it on and turn it off and have some control. Mm-hmm. And so I had a project that showed up that was just that. And the guy said, I need some help with conversion rate optimization, but I also need traffic. And I said, well, I'm pretty good at the CRO stuff, but the traffic, I'm willing to take it on, but just so you know, I don't have any experience doing this, right? If you trust me enough, I'm happy to give it a shot, but I can't tell you what the results are going to be. Mm-hmm. And he said, sure. And then a month later, he's like getting pretty angry, going like, why aren't we getting more results? And I'm like, I don't know. I'm spending his money and he's like just throwing money at it.
Yeah.
And I don't know. And lo and behold, he had pitted me against another consultant without telling me about it.
Oh, wow.
And essentially in a very unceremonious way, sort of like Donald Trump going on television and firing Rex Tillerson before he told him.
Yeah.
That's kind of how it felt to me, where in his email inbox were emails from this other consultant all along, and he was secretly weighing us against each other in this sort of Darwinian free-for-all for his business.
Wow.
And then I was fired like a month later.
Yeah.
I mean, he paid me.
Yeah.
And I felt really bad. I probably tried for about a month to like, well, let me do something else then.
Yeah.
Let me make it up to you kind of thing. Yeah. It was deeply embarrassing in that it reminded me that I totally went about this the wrong way.
What did you do wrong?
I think what I should have done is started doing traffic buys for myself and experimenting for myself and having some certainty that it's a service that I could deliver and scale for other people. Now, maybe this is the crux of your question. I think there's always this tension when you're offering something new. You don't really know how good you're going to be at providing it.
Yes.
And there's a couple ways to address that. One is, what's the smallest version of that service that you can deliver and still be valuable?
Yeah.
And another is, be cheaper than you think you're worth, just so that the stakes aren't quite as high for either party. So I think this is a good transition into, that's how I approach my advisory services. So I was wondering, actually, Philip, I'll talk about mine, but would you talk a little bit about your stretch goal was to move completely to advisory rather than done for you hands consulting work.
Yeah.
How did you approach that?
This, I think, is, now that you said it, it's another way I could have stated this at the beginning that might have been clearer, is how do you learn? Like, how do you acquire the ability to deliver new skills? If you're a CPA and you want to start doing some new thing, there's probably a class or a training program that you can take that aligns with the certification, and you take it and you get certified, and maybe you're not great at it at first, but you've kind of got this infrastructure behind you that says, well, this person has received what the profession's overlords deem to be the adequate amount of training to do this. You know, dentist, you want to start performing some kind of new cosmetic procedure because it's really profitable. You can go to a workshop and learn how to do it. So anyway, I feel like a lot of us are kind of adrift about how we learn, we gain new capabilities. Anyway, I'm just trying to do a better job of establishing the premise of the show, and I think that ship has sailed. Anyway.
No, I think we got it.
You asked, how did I go about transitioning to all advisory services? I follow Alan Weiss on Twitter, and he about half the time pisses me off, which I think is part of his MO, is like, let's just kind of force people to think differently, yada, yada.
I have a rule, Philip, which is to never fully trust someone who poses leaning against a Rolls Royce. That's my rule. I think it's a good rule for life.
I'm biting my tongue. So moving on. He has said something that I just...
It's okay, Alan. Write me. Philip didn't say it. Alan, I'm up for the challenge. Talk to me.
Send your correspondence to listen at offlinepodcast.rocks.io.listen.io. One of the things he said that it's interesting to me, because I'm not sure where I land on this, is he'll tweet this, and this is in his carousel of rotating tweets. If you want to get out of training, just stop offering training. If you want to get into something new, start offering that. It's that simple. That's the essence of what this tweet says. And I know it's a tweet, and I probably shouldn't get too worked up about a tweet. But sometimes I'm like, it's not that fucking simple. Okay, it takes a lot of courage. It takes preparation. It might take a little bit of sacrifice to make these kind of drastic changes to your service offerings.
Okay, so hold on. Let's not live in the emotional world, though. And the reason I say that is like, can you focus on the behaviors, the actual behaviors or actions you took in order to
totally
transition?
Well, just to close that out, sometimes I think he's right. It's a simple choice combined with a lot of follow through. And you're asking, what's the follow through? Like, I've had this, you could call it a decision or a goal or a vision for what I wanted to create. It doesn't really matter because you're trying to say, what did I actually do? What did I do to make this happen?
Yep.
About the time that I made this decision, I had some advisory services offerings. So you could buy a version of my book that included a 1-hour consultation. You could be a part of the Positioning Accelerator program. I guess the problem was those constituted less than 100% of what I needed in terms of revenue. But also, just so folks know, like, I was already doing those things. And so one of the things I did was, completely honest here, I thrashed around a lot. I experimented with different service offerings. So I said, the Positioning Accelerator program, I like that. That's now $500 a month, one meeting a week with two groups of five people. And why don't I make a lower touch, lower cost version of that called Positioning Office Hours? And that was a service that I ultimately wound down because I just didn't like the dynamics of it. I didn't feel like I could give enough value to make it worth it. And the price point was too low. So I tried some different things. Like, I tried putting up some, and I did the thing that you should really never do, which is just experiment on your website and hope that that turns into business. I did some of that. You know what I mean? So it's like, hey, I'll write up a description for the service, stick it on my services page and see what happens.
Yeah.
Well, what would you predict happens?
Probably nothing.
If you're not Amazon.com, nothing happens, you know?
Well, that's a little bit of a ridiculous statement.
Yeah, it's overly binary, yeah.
But if you don't already have existing traffic, yeah. Yeah.
That's what I was trying. It was just an analogy, but yeah, you're right. I pushed that a little too far.
It's sort of an absurd example. Yeah. Yeah, but go ahead.
So I thrashed around. I tried some things. Through that, I noticed that sometimes people would see value in a private coaching arrangement. And so I sold some of that. In some months, that meant that I was meeting my income goals entirely from the advisory services. Mm-hmm. And other months, it meant like, oh, there's more work to do here because the advisory services are not carrying 100% of the heavy lifting here in terms of supporting my extravagant California lifestyle.
Yes.
What other actions did I take? I mean, I kept doing what I was already doing, which is emailing my list daily and sometimes promoting these new advisory services. And I developed specialization school. And that was, I think, a big part of like finding, let's call it product market fit in something that's advisory in nature, but my list wanted to buy. Not every person on my list, but enough that I'm like, this is working. It's a slow build, but this is actually working. So I don't know. I guess we could simplify that a bit, listen, and say that I did what Alan Weiss advised. I offered advisory services, experimented a fair bit, and I was already halfway there. That's probably the critical thing. That's the thing where certain people would write the story up into a blog post and neglect to mention that and to make themselves look amazing. And I just refuse to do
that. Yeah, I think that's an important point to make. So I think there's an accrual of choices that come to fruition and come to bear when you made the change. And same for me. So I, more than a year ago, in April or May of last year, 2017, mm-hmm. I stopped actively pursuing GoodFunnel, which was my marketing business.
Yeah.
And my partner and I split ways, and he took the clients, and I wanted to focus on sales. And I actually agree with Alan's advice, more or less. Mm-hmm. I agree with you. There's like an element of courage, and there's, you want to have some foundational assets in place, or at least you need some money in the bank,
yeah,
knowing that it's going to take some months And in some cases, you know, I've heard some people say, oh yeah, it takes a year before you make any money. I don't agree with that. I sort of think like you need to hustle harder. Yeah. It shouldn't take you a year to get people to pay you money.
Yeah.
But it's going to take some months to really get your revenue to a place where you want it.
Yeah.
So I did the sales training business that didn't work out. And then in December of last year, I was a free agent again. And I went, well, what am I going to do now?
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew that I wanted to offer sales training. I knew that I really love to help people. I knew that the environment where I'm the best is when I'm speaking to people and I'm actively giving them advice that they can implement in action quickly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The other thing is coaching. So in this case, we're talking about advisory. All of the advice that you're hearing right now too, I think is equally applicable to if you don't want to give up services, but you want to do some more strategic engagements where you're getting paid for advice, but it's not coaching. I think this all applies to that as well. For me, in January is when I landed my first coaching client. Part of it was going to people and saying, hey, I'm doing coaching now. If you think I might be able to help you, I'd love to talk to you for an hour and we can make a joint decision if that would work or not.
There's an important thing there too. Like I talked about just like throwing spaghetti on the wall in the form of adding new services to my services page. I know that a lot of folks are going to experience this idea as a sort of catch-22 or like a chicken and egg thing. I want to offer services that are higher value than what I'm offering now, but who's going to buy those? Because the perception is what I'm selling now is some kind of ceiling for what I can sell. And I'm curious if you I feel like there's a thread of something that's an answer to that and what you just said, where you went out, am I right about this? You shopped your offer around to people you already knew who were current or previous clients. For the folks at home, how specifically did you handle that? You had this new offer of coaching. I don't think you went to coach school. So
I did not.
It's not like something you've quote unquote trained for. So this is an example of you leaning out a little bit ahead of your skis, I'm sure.
Yes and no, though. I mean, you and I were both mentors in an online program mm-hmm. where we had, I believe it was over 100 mentees, I guess is the
right. No.
Yeah, that's the right terminology. We had sea cows, lots of them. I had some practice there. I'd also done in-person, I guess training isn't the right word, but like classes at General Assembly uh-huh. where I'd had hundreds of students over the course of like 18 months. So it wasn't brand new.
Yeah.
I think there was leverage there in terms of a lot of my past experience was applicable to coaching, but it wasn't exactly coaching. So to a degree, you're right. Like I didn't know how good of a coach would I be, but I did have an inkling.
Yeah, right.
To address this idea that you brought up about courage, I think it was a little bit easier for me to say, well, let's give this a try because I dipped my toe in the water lots of different ways already. But ultimately, people were still coming to me. I was still getting marketing leads
mm-hmm.
because I built lead generation engines that still work.
Yeah.
I mean, I still get leads for that.
Yeah.
Not nearly as many now because I haven't done anything for over a year to keep it going.
That's one of those funny things that I hear over and over about these kind of lead generation flywheels. Content marketing could be one of those, is people will change direction and then they'll be like, when I talked to Eric Davis, I think he's the first interview on the Consulting Pipeline podcast ever. He got really involved in an open source community and he like to this day, years, like, I don't know, 5-7 years later, still gets leads from that activity. So there's mm-hmm. this, you know, once the flywheel's going and you step away from it, it's able to keep going for quite a while. Anyway. Slight tangent.
It does. I mean, I just talked to a guy who heard me on a podcast that wasn't even about my sales coaching, and he read everything he could find on me, including all my content on Liston.io, and then reached out and was like, we need to talk because I want your help, and I totally understand who you are as a person, and I want to work with you.
Yeah.
So I think part of it, to the point you brought up, the tweet that Alan Weiss put up, I think it is correct. Like, when people came to me for marketing help, I just said, no, I don't do that anymore, but I do these other things. Do you want to talk about that?
Right.
And occasionally people would say yes, but often they'd say no.
Yep.
And that's fine.
Yeah.
But I mean, really, it was about, I think for me, one of the biggest shifts and one of the pieces of advice I would give to people is if you hate what you're doing now or you want to shift, you really need to fully commit to it, because if you don't, you're not going to get the benefit in the full weight of the decisions that you're making and the activities you're undergoing in order to market and sell yourself, right? You're going to be split between multiple things, and it's really hard to complete that shift if you're split. That's what I found, at least, is when I said, okay, no, fuck it. I'm doing coaching, I'm doing advisory, or I'm doing sales consulting. Mm-hmm. I'm not doing marketing projects unless in some sort of like really specific cases. Like, I still have one marketing client, but there's leverage, right? Generally, I'm just saying like, no, I'm going all in on this thing. Yeah. And certainly I'm not going to do any done for you work.
Yeah.
Those days are gone. I'm not going to do that unless it's a multiple five-figure project and they can space it out over many months, so I'm not trading off my other responsibilities to my existing clients. Yeah. Another thing, Philip, is the business model is different when you do advisory. You have more clients who pay you less money, but overall you have the chance of actually making more, or at least I did, based on what I was making before.
Yeah, not to be disagreeable. There are people who do advisory work where they have like two clients, and so they might actually have less. I've seen it go both ways. So just my perspective is the business model for you and I, because we're selling to smaller businesses, is a higher volume of lower price point clients. Mm-hmm. But I've seen the reverse, lower volume of higher price clients, like big fat retainers. So that to me brings out the point that within the world of advisory services, there's lots of options. It's not just you're flying around on airplanes and showing up at board meetings and you have two clients.
Right, exactly. And what I was going to get to is I don't like that business model where I'm dependent on two companies, or probably more realistically, two individual people deciding how much money I'm going to make and whether or not I get paid next month. Yeah. So it takes a lot longer to build up a bunch of individuals who are paying you on a regular basis. But once you get it, it's like, man, that's freeing, where I can say, okay, even if I lost one of my biggest retainer clients, I'd be fine. Yeah. No one is more than 20% of my revenue. That's enormous.
Yeah, right. It's more than a paper cut, but it's not like a bleeding jugular vein kind of a wound.
Well, no, because I know how to hustle up some more business too. And I have now 30 or 40 people in my pipeline who've expressed direct interest but haven't bought anything, and I can go back to them.
Let me ask you this. I'm getting a sense that when you make decisions, you go all in, and I wonder if you do that to sort of raise the stakes so that you're more committed to the decision you've just made, like more committed in terms of follow through. Not that you wouldn't be, but I'm curious if that's something you consciously do.
No, I was just going to say it's not conscious. It's like,
okay.
When I make up my mind that I'm going to do something, that like my world is forever changed. That's just the way it is now. That's the story I tell myself.
Okay.
That's just who I am. I don't know if that's a transferable piece of advice that I could give to other people.
Yeah, I have a GIF I made from one of the opening scenes to this cheesy kung fu movie, The Master of the Flying Guillotine. Have you ever seen that one?
No.
Oh, it's so fun. I saw it in a theater in Portland. And
oh, nice.
Very campy. This guy, this kung fu master, learns that his disciples have been murdered. He lives in the mountains in a kind of a shack. And he gets mad. He jumps up through the roof of the shack and lands like 30 feet away. He jumps like 50 feet in the air.
Naturally.
And then pulls this thing out of his pocket and throws it, and it's like the whole house blows up and goes into flame, and he sets out on a mission of revenge. And I think that's one way that people embrace change, is they're like, the old thing is dead. You're dead to me, old thing. We're doing this now. And it's like a complete commitment to that. And it sounds like that's more the model you pursue.
Yeah. I mean, it is. I think this time it served me really well. Mm-hmm. I just think it's hard. Let's put it this way. I talked to someone yesterday, and he is simultaneously trying to run three very different businesses. Two of them are related, but one of them is totally unrelated to the other two.
Oh, wow.
And I think it's very difficult to build a business, just one single one.
Oh, yeah.
And so if you want your business to be advisory, here's what I would say. Splitting your time and attention is going to limit the amount of progress you can make. There should be no argument there, right? Like, just by definition, if you're putting 50 instead of 100% of your effort into something, you're only going to get half the benefit, maybe less, right? What I'd say is that if you wanted to go into advisory or into consulting or some new service line, you can do that and commit to it for, say, 3 months. And then if it doesn't work out, you can always go back to what you were doing before. You don't need to update your entire website. You don't need to change all of your marketing properties. Like, that doesn't need to be done. But what you could say is, all my new effort will go exclusively to this thing.
Yeah.
And I want to give it enough time to see if it's going to work.
Yeah. I was just reflecting to a Q&A call I was hosting earlier today. And there are lots of folks who have that kind of the two R's working for them, repeat business and referrals. And that's led to stagnation, but also the stagnation is not an emergency. It's like, well, I want things to be better, but I can kind of roll with what with this. And you're right, that does free up time and energy to focus on what's new, as long as the status quo isn't consuming 100% of your time and energy.
Right.
Personally, I have this mission, this desire that more people take seriously the idea of specializing in some way, people in the world of software development. And that forces me to do one of two things. There's two things I can do with that. One is I can say, well, it's just not for everybody. I'm just going to focus on the people for who it's obviously a good fit for. But my inclination has been to say, well, I wonder if there's creative ways that people can make use of this, even if it's not obviously a good fit. So what about the person who wants to make their business better? I know I'm talking about specialization, but I really mean anything that would make your business better that takes time and energy to do. How do you do that if you're kind of stuck in the status quo? Like, how do you free up the time and energy to make things better? I don't have an answer for that question. There's no one answer to that question, but it's a question that I think about because, to me, that expands the scope of who I can be helpful to. If I have at least ideas for that situation, I know there's a lot of people who would say, well, you just shouldn't be self-employed if you can't spend half your time working on your business or whatever.
Well, I don't agree with that.
And I'm not saying that's your position either. I wasn't throwing you into the bus there. I'm just saying, I think some people would say, well, you're just not cut out for this. If you can't spend some time working on the business, it's not going to go anywhere. You should just get a job.
What I would say is, except for rare exceptions where you get lucky and maybe you're working on something that you just happen to have perfect timing. It's mm-hmm. So like there was in San Luis Obispo, there were two graduates of San Luis Obispo, the university, uh-huh. I forget what it's called.
Okay.
They did app design uh-huh. at a time when apps were just really taken off.
Right, yeah.
Like 2011, I think,
okay.
is when they started doing it. They happened to be in an area that had a little bit of startup stuff going on. There's some VCs around. And because they were good at that at the right time and they were hustling their asses off, they were able to grow strictly through referrals a pretty good size agency.
Yeah, sure.
That's rare. That's rare that you're going to do that, that all of those things are going to align, right time, right place, right mix of people, hustling just enough. That's really rare.
Well, I was just thinking, I bet if you survey the top 100 agencies ranked by size or revenue, that story is probably has outsized representation among that cohort. Meaning, I think that might be more of a factor in their success than anything else. And I know that's a little bit of a not nice thing to say, because that means, well, your business decisions weren't why you succeeded or got to this point. In other words, I'm really just talking about survivorship bias.
That's a good point. I can tell you from my life that decisions matter and the things that we do matter.
I'm not saying they don't, but was luck more of a factor than the decisions? And I know that's a complete oversimplification. I'm just saying, I think you look at the big survivors and I think luck is going to play a big role.
Totally agree with that. Like, to become ultra wealthy, luck is a gigantic factor. I mean, just think of all the chance meetings or opportunities that it takes for people. I mean, like, great example, right? Bill Gates finding QDOS, which originally stood for Quick and Dirty Operating System, because it was such a piece of shit and it was whipped together. And he bought it outright, cash, yeah. right time, right place, repackaged a really shitty product into MS-DOS, which became the dominant operating system in the world.
Let me ask you this on that note. Do you find the celebration of Charlie Munger, the other guy?
Warren Buffett.
Yeah, Warren Buffett, a little like leaves a bad taste in your mouth for the reasons we're talking about here?
Well, I think they have a much better track record of most entrepreneurs compared to most entrepreneurs that we celebrate. And they've been doing it for a very, very long time.
Maybe I see the celebration as a little bit one-sided, like they're so smart to the exclusion of, well, they might have also been a little lucky or they might have had a head start or something.
I think what you're referring to is like how the press treats them versus like if you listen to Warren Buffett talk, he'll tell you that luck has played a major role in his career.
You're right. I am talking about how other people talk about them, not about how they talk about themselves.
So I try not to think about, I try not to think too much about how the press glorifies things. Yeah. I try to go to the source.
That's good advice. Damn, that's good advice.
Right? Because everything is mythologized to an extent. So like I was talking to someone, he was talking about how he would go to these tech competitions where they would award like best startup. And he goes, but most of these companies fail. He said, it's all hype. Most of these companies fail. And I said, well, yeah, it's an event. The purpose of the event is to entertain you while you're there and to get you to buy a ticket next year. It's not to produce working businesses.
Yeah.
Right. So like the incentives are totally misaligned. Same thing with the way the press treats entrepreneurs is they're sort of deified.
Yeah. I have more to say on that, but I'm going to not say it now.
Maybe that's another topic for another day, but I forgot how we got on this tangent. What was your original question, Philip?
I don't know. It's buried a couple layers deep here. I think we launched off on this. I asked you if you intentionally go all in order to kind of raise the stakes and just like give yourself even more reasons to follow through. And you said, no, that's not an intentional thing. I think that might have kind of led us where we are now.
Yeah, no, it's not an intentional thing. I think that I was talking about splitting your time and I was talking about not having to update all of your marketing assets in order to try something new. I think what I would suggest is kind of a useful thing moving forward is to think about like, oh, I know what I was going to say. Here we go. We're back on it. One thing you mentioned is like, what really was at stake when you did this and how were you able to free up more of your time to dedicating to a percentage of your business to build your business? And should you not even have a business if you can't designate X percent to building it?
Right.
And here's what I would say to that is unless you get extremely lucky, now we're back on the path. That's what took us away. Unless you get extremely lucky, you should dedicate, I would say, about half your business or more. I spend more than half of my time on building my business and giving away free shit than I do for billable stuff, stuff that I actually get paid for.
Right.
How did I do that? Well, two things. One is the model of being in the advisory business means it takes way less of my time to service my clients in a very, even a high touch way that leaves them all extremely satisfied and gives them results. So it takes up less of my time in this delivery model. But let me be completely honest. Last year when I started the sales training business, I went, I think, 4 months without taking any draw. And then when I started the new iteration of the training business, where I landed my first client January 2nd or 3rd of this year, I spent 3 months making less money than I'd ever made other than the months where I made zero. But in any months where I made a dollar or more, I made less money in the first 3 months of this year than I had since I think I started in entrepreneurship. Now that said, I'm on track now this year because I've had a really big April and June. I think July is poised to be really good as well. I'm on track to make it all up and still maybe even have my best year ever. But I was able to do that. And I'll admit, I don't have children except for my two very expensive pets. I don't have children. And so that takes some of the pressure off. I do have a mortgage. We did have savings in the bank. But it's a little bit of a hardship. And I want to be clear about that. Like, that was my story, and I'm not saying it has to be yours, but I don't want to put this sheen or facade onto this and make it seem like it was all clear sailing and it all just worked out. And I still had 300 people on my email list and hundreds of people who I'd worked with in some sort of mentorship or coaching capacity mm-hmm. that I could go back and talk to.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's not necessarily easy, but I think what it does require is commitment.
Yeah, I think sometimes you're going to sacrifice in the short term to make these kind of changes. When I think about it through that lens, I realize part of what drove me to do it maybe is just some kind of natural ambition. But another part of it was when I was doing more of the done-for-you work, I was sacrificing, let's call it quality of life or enjoyment, to stand still. And I was like, well, if I can sacrifice just to stand still, maybe I could redirect some of that sacrifice towards actually changing things for the better. And that worked out. But again, like you, I want to take pains to point out that I had a head start that I'd been sort of building on the side that I somewhat happened into and then saw something I liked. And it was like, well, let's put some wood on that fire. I like how that one works. Again, none of this is like, I just hate those artificial hero stories where your hero happens to have a massive tailwind that you don't, and you're comparing yourself to them without knowing about this tailwind that they had.
I feel like Offline is becoming the I Call Bullshit podcast.
That's our tagline.
Yeah, right. There's no business owner with a reputable business that's set up for long-term success that I know of that was any sort of overnight success. Mm-hmm. And I know you've written about this a lot, but like for instance, I'll give you a perfect example. Here's a great headline. How I went from zero LinkedIn video views to over 10,000 per week in less than 6 months. Okay, well, let's pull that apart, right? Like, how was I able to do that? Well, I had 4 years of digital marketing experience, so I knew the right questions to ask. I knew how to accelerate my learning. I already knew media production before doing this. And by the way, minor detail, I put like 10 to 20 hours a week into it.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's not like snap your fingers and the shit just happens. Yeah. I mean, it's years and years. And for me, 20 years of media production experience, producing audio and video and digital photographs and right. not professionally, but like a really dedicated hobby.
Yeah, right. Like you had, I mean, would you say that you really gave a good try to a music career that didn't go anywhere and that was part of it too?
Yeah, and I have expert level production experience.
Right, yeah.
Like, for instance, I took a video editing class here in Portland just to learn how to use Premiere a little bit better. And by this, maybe not the second lesson, but by the time I walked out of there, I was like, I'm totally sure I could teach that class better than she did.
Yeah.
Not that I didn't learn anything. I definitely did, just partially just from sitting there and doing it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that experience is huge versus someone who's sitting down and learning all this stuff from scratch. I knew which microphones to buy. I knew how to set up my lighting. I mean, just the list goes on, man. There's just a lot that goes into it.
Yeah.
Did we scare everyone away, Philip?
I don't see anybody out in the audience. I think they all left.
Well, that's because you're sitting in a shed.
I'm in the podcasting shed.
Yes, the studio, we'll call it.
Indeed, yeah. It's the shed where the washer and dryer are here in our storage, and I'm looking out at a beautiful tree. This is, for me anyway, a pretty great place to have to record these podcasts with you.
Well, Philip, this is where I want to leave it, because the original question was, how do you take on stretch goals that lead to growth rather than failure? I think for me, where I started was, I want to do advisory. I know we focused on how we both transitioned our business, so I just want to wrap up in that context. Right. I wanted to do advisory, and I just said, okay, I'm going to do that, and I'm not going to offer anything else. Even though I know it's going to cost me money, mm-hmm. I'm only going to do things that lead to an advisory-based business, which would lend itself eventually to products and speaking, which is where I want my business to go.
Yeah.
So now every decision becomes about that. There's no way for me to overemphasize how much of a difference that makes. And I want you, dear listener, to give yourself permission to do whatever it is that you want to do. I was listening to Gary Vee. I'm obsessed with a show called Hot Ones, Philip, where they ask hot questions and eat hotter wings.
Okay. And,
dude, it's amazing. And he had Gary Vee on, and Gary Vee smashed it. He, like, obviously, he's so competitive, right?
Uh-huh.
So he did a great job with the hot wings. But the point is, when it was over, he was like, look, life goes on for a long time. Do the things that you want to do, because there's no reason for you to be miserable 40, 50 hours a week, right? So if you want to make the change, I would say, look at what assets you have in place now, what little steps you can take towards that change, and then forget about the stretch goal. Now it's all about action. Just keep executing. Do those things that you need to do over and over and over again.
Alan Weiss would be proud. You want me to write him and let him know that you took his advice?
I'm probably already dead to him based on what I said.
You're really sorry for contacting him on LinkedIn.
You didn't back me up on this podcast. So without your endorsement, there's no way he's going to pay attention to me.
Have you ever had a hot chicken in Nashville, Tennessee?
No, I have not.
Oh.
Is it spicy?
It is hot? Spicy. I mean, yeah, it's spicy hot, not just temperature hot. It's spicy hot.
Is that the name of a restaurant, or that's the name of a dish, hot chicken?
It's the name of a dish that's kind of somewhat regionally affiliated with Nashville. Check out Prince's Hot Chicken Shack next time you're in Nashville.
Well, we might be going this summer.
Oh, seriously?
Yeah. I want to go to Memphis, Nashville, and then maybe Atlanta.
Okay. Well, please do go to Prince's Hot Chicken Shack. Make sure that whatever is going to happen in the next day of your trip doesn't distance you from a bathroom excessively.
This is a strong sell.
Well, it's worth it, I think, for the experience. But if someone eats like a ghost pepper or whatever, there's going to be some suffering afterwards. And you know, that's just part of it.
There's a price to pay. I agree.
Yeah, you got to sacrifice to have these experiences.
All right, my friend, let's leave it on that note. Prince's Hot Chicken, courtesy of Philip Morgan.
Super good to talk to you, buddy.
All right, brother. Bye. Talk to you soon. Bye.